I'm going to try today to suggest that there is a way to see the glass that is Detroit as half full. Okay, 3/8 full. There is a scenario in which Detroit recovers, not just the car companies, but the city as well, and once again becomes a symbol of something besides urban ruin, collapse, and competitive failure.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our speaker today is Joseph B. White. Joe White, a Harvard graduate, is the senior editor for the Wall Street Journal and writes the Eyes on the Road feature every Monday for the online version of the journal. Joe White has worked at the journal since 1987. He covers and has covered the automobile industry from Detroit. In 1993, Joe and Paul Ingracia shared a Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting for their coverage of management turmoil at General Motors. Joe and Paul also co-authored a 1994 book about the American automobile industry in the 80s and 90s called Comeback, The Fall and Rise of the American Automobile Industry. Somehow I think I smell a sequel to that book. Please welcome Joe White.
Thanks, George. Yeah, I owe a double thanks to George for bailing me out. My talk is not about the importance of having your own car and personal transportation in the United States, but it could be. All right. So I'm really pleased to be here. It's a great privilege. I took the bait that George offered me when we talked about doing this, the bait was to talk on the title, Can We Save Detroit? Now, if I say Detroit, what comes to mind? Let me guess. Ruined city full of boarded up houses, right? Laid off auto workers, empty factories, bankrupt or nearly bankrupt car companies, broken by unsustainable union contracts and uninspiring cars. Right? Right. All true. Detroit has and is all these things, sadly. But that is not what I want to talk about today, at least not entirely. I'm going to try today to suggest that there is a way to see the glass that is Detroit as half full. Okay, 3/8 full. It's not totally empty. There is a scenario in which Detroit recovers, not just the car companies, but the city as well, and once again becomes a symbol of something besides urban ruin, collapse, and competitive failure. Can we save Detroit? That depends on what your definition of Detroit, quote, is. And I think most of us, many of you, when you think of Detroit and used in that way, what you think of are three big auto companies, which sell most of the cars and trucks in the United States, employ factory workers at wages and benefits roughly $60 to $70 an hour, two or three times the national manufacturing average, maintain brands such as Buick or Pontiac that are as old as a century, support thousands of dealerships in cities large and small, sustain generous pensions, health care benefits for more than 1 million retirees and their dependents. Well, no, that Detroit isn't going to survive. It's already dead. The events of the past few weeks and in the events that will ensue in the next few weeks are just going to ratify something that's already basically happened. GM's restructuring, whether it's in or out of bankruptcy court, is going to bring down the curtain on an era in America's economic history that lasted roughly the lifetime of many of the people who are taking pensions from GM right now. And I would date it from 1936, which was the date of the Flint sit-down strike that established the UAW as a major power in the auto business and really in the country from that time, until March 30th of this year, when President Obama essentially said from the presidential podium that Chrysler was going to have to find a partner, Fiat, and that GM was going to have to undergo the massive restructuring that it's undertaking as we speak. These companies are going to emerge from this process, if they emerge at all, as substantially smaller companies. They're going to be paying fewer workers, and they're going to be paying them a lot less. their primacy in the American industrial scene is probably going to be diminished. Just those companies, I want to come back to that in a little bit, but just those two companies will no longer be the powerhouses that they once were. Now, I don't want to dwell on this, but I just want to say that, you know, nobody who gets caught in an industry that's undergoing creative destruction particularly enjoys it. If you doubt that, ask anyone in the newspaper business. We have our own business model problems. And I don't really want to make light of the suffering that's going on in the auto industry right now. It's pretty profound, and a lot of people's lives are going to be disrupted. Promises are going to be broken. Plans and life plans and aspirations are going to be greatly disappointed. But I do want to try to make a case that what's happening to GM and Ford and Chrysler, Ford's not going bankrupt, but it's undergoing a pretty rigorous restructuring, is not only unavoidable, but it ultimately could be for the best, provided that the companies are able to survive the economic crisis and whatever happens afterwards. Before I get into sort of trying to build a positive case for you, let me quickly review how the big three got into the mess that they're in right now. What I'm about to talk about is, I think, mainly about General Motors, because in my view, this crisis and the government's extraordinary intervention in the auto industry is almost entirely about General Motors. General Motors, just to remind those of you who might have forgotten, used to be an industrial juggernaut. It was possibly the most powerful and certainly the largest industrial corporation in America and the world. Back in the 1950s, GM's biggest problem was that the government was thinking about using antitrust power to break it up. They were the Microsoft of the 1950s. They were the company that everybody feared. They were dominant in just about every way. Until 1985, which, you know, think about it, it's not that long ago, they still sold 40% of the cars and trucks in the United States market. And they had made money pretty much, well, I think they had made money every year through the Depression, through World War II, through the 1950s, 1960s, recessions, booms. They were a company that just made money consistently, and they dominated the industry both in this country and globally. The only country that mattered where they didn't have a presence was Japan, and guess what? They didn't care, really. They used it as a talking point every once in a while in debates about trade policy. Otherwise, they were totally dominant. So how does a juggernaut like this become a basket case that we see before us today? I'm going to oversimplify and cite quickly five factors that I think over the past 30 years have brought us to where we are. First, GM underestimated the competition. Their marketing and engineering machinery just didn't comprehend in the 1970s the appeal of a car like the Volkswagen Beetle, the Datsun 240Z, or any of the Hondas that came subsequently in the late 70s or the early 1980s. When the oil price shocks of the 1970s hit, GM leaders underestimated the damage that was done to their brands and their franchises by the poor design and poor quality of the vehicles that they rushed out to respond to new government fuel economy mandates and to the changing market. Now, GM has improved quality dramatically in the last few years, not fast enough, I think. Probably many of you might agree. But unfortunately, the company believed, for some reason, that the way to success would be to offer pale copies of boring Japanese cars. You know, unfortunately, people who want a boring Japanese car don't need a copy. They can get plenty of the real thing assembled not really that far from here in eastern Kentucky or several other states in this country. Second, GM mismanaged its relationship with the United Auto Workers Union, and the UAW, in its turn, mismanaged its relationship with GM and also with Ford and Chrysler, but I'll focus on GM. The management and the union failed to defuse a demographic time bomb that has now blown up their collective futures. They knew that it was there. They knew that it was there in the early 1990s for sure. They knew that the GM healthcare plan was a promise that the company could not keep. They didn't act to turn the ship around until 2007, by which time, basically, the iceberg was under the keel. Third, and I think this is something that I'd want to come back to in a little bit, or this idea, that over the last 30 years, GM and Ford and Chrysler have all handled failure far better than they handled success. This was kind of the theme of the book that Paul Ingrassi and I wrote back in the early 90s about these companies. When they were struck down by the oil shocks and the subsequent recession in the late 70s and early 1980s, all three of these companies, certainly Chrysler and Ford, did some of their most innovative thinking about what kinds of vehicles and cars and products people wanted to buy. Just as a quick example, the Chrysler minivan, which came out in the mid-1980s, perfectly catching the wave of baby boomers who were starting their families and were looking around and saying, I've got two kids or three kids, what am I going to put them in? Station wagons had been more or less outlawed by the fuel economy regulations. Those of you who remember the big old Ford LTD wagons, those things were off the road. What was there to drive? Bingo, Chrysler minivan. They made a fortune. So it's not like they couldn't figure out what people wanted. It's just that they only seemed to do it when their old path had been blown up and they said, oh my gosh, we got to let the guy who has the crazy ideas have his way once in a while. You could cite examples in each of the three companies where I think this was the case. During times of success, these companies all managed to find ways to squander their wealth on really ill-considered schemes. I mean, certainly ill-considered in hindsight. Just as a quick cite on that, GM's foray into subprime mortgages undertaken in the early part of this decade, which has now basically destroyed General Motors Acceptance Corp, which used to be one of the most successful money-making franchises in any business anywhere. Fourth, GM did in fact rely too heavily on a few gas-hungry trucks and SUVs for all their profits, plus the money they needed to cover the losses on many of their car lines. Now, they did this for a really good reason. When gas was cheap, as it has been for most of the past 20 years, with a few notable exceptions, big gas-guzzling trucks and SUVs are exactly what their customers wanted. People who wanted a small Toyota had plenty of them to buy. They didn't need GM's version of that. But what GM did better than anybody else was build a vehicle like the Chevy Suburban. And when you are the management of GM and you see the profit and loss sheets for your different model lines, and Chevy Suburban is coming back with a profit of $8,000 to $10,000, maybe $12,000 per vehicle, dollars per vehicle. And your Chevy Cavalier, which is up against the Corolla or the Honda Accord or the Honda Civic, is coming back with -$2,000, -$4,000 loss per vehicle. Where do you think they're going to put their money? The government abetted this with fuel economy rules that are so complicated, I refuse to explain them to you. But let me just say, and I think there's no doubt about this, that the combination of the fuel economy rules, which were easier on trucks like the Chevy Suburban or the Chevy Tahoe, and harder on cars, coupled with Washington's real energy policy, which is keep gas cheap at all costs, led the car makers to do what they did. Finally, on sort of the list of sins, I don't have seven. GM refused to accept that to survive, this is successive years of management, by the way. There's not any one person who I'm trying to put blame on here. But institutionally and as a leadership, they refused to accept that to survive, they simply could not remain what they were in the 1950s and 1960s. With multiple brands, eight at last count, and a company that was geared to have and survive on a dominant market share. They used, as probably most of you are aware, a lot of short-term strategies in the last decade to try to avoid reckoning with the consequences of globalization and their own mistakes. One obvious consequence of globalization is that we have a parallel auto industry in the United States right now, which has been lost, I think, in the discussion in Washington. We talk about the auto industry as if that is synonymous with the Detroit Three. It's not. There are, and I'm going to mistake the count here, but it's something like eight other car makers building cars in the United States. Three or four of them building quite a large number of cars in the United States. Our market has gone from being a 2.5 company oligopoly in the 1980s, even into the 1990s, to a 8-12 company free-for-all, as you see in Europe. That's a huge change in the economic reality, which the Detroit companies didn't reckon with until basically now. GM has only recently announced that it's going to sell Saturn, kill Pontiac, unload Saab and Hummer, and try to focus on a mere 4 brands. But that's still basically 2 more than Toyota uses to sell almost as many vehicles with about a fifth as many dealers. Okay, so we are where we are. I mean, there will be a lot of finger pointing and blame apportioning, but it doesn't really matter because now the question is, how are we going to get out of the ditch? We, meaning the American taxpayer who is now invested in this proposition, coasting toward $80+ billion with more to come. We, meaning the people of the upper Midwest who do rely on the car business for the economy. And we, as a broader economy, that I think still has a lot of anxiety about losing our manufacturing base. And for good or ill, cars are still a big part of that. Okay, here's the good news. The age of denial in Detroit is over. I mean, the denialists have lost their jobs. They're gone, everybody. This economic crisis is going to force the Detroit 3, particularly GM, to take the medicine that they didn't want to swallow for the last 20 years. GM can now shed the debts that it cannot pay if they use bankruptcy or if they were able to successfully restructure out of bankruptcy. They can close the factories that they don't need. They can compel the workers that they can't support to seek their fortunes elsewhere because they're no longer, the unions agreed no longer to basically force the company to pay people who have no jobs. They will slash the obligations to retirees that they can't meet anyway. And if they use the bankruptcy process, they'll be able to steer clear of the tangle of laws that protect their dealerships that they don't really need either. They can focus on designing fewer but better cars and trucks. They can use their human and financial resources to bring to market technology that's been sitting in the lab for lack of capital or lack of initiative that will make a difference in terms of in real world fuel efficiency and energy saving. And I'm happy to take questions on that subject, but there's what you can do tomorrow and there's what you can do in 20 years. Now they can do the stuff that they could have done in the short term because they're going to be free to do that. If they get their house in order, this may not be good news for you, for those of you who are about to buy a car, but if they get their house in order, they won't have to flood the market with vehicles that nobody wants to buy. They don't have to run revenue-destroying fire sales, good for shareholders, not so good for the car shopper. And that actually helps their rivals. All right. So let's imagine it's 5 years from now. Everything has gone according to plan. It's all worked. What do we have? We're going to have an American car business, production and sales, that's not dominated by the three Detroit-based companies, but instead, as I suggested, close to a dozen car companies headquartered in various parts of the world who are employing Americans on assembly lines and in higher paid engineering, marketing, design, and financial jobs. We have a broader base, which is good. Some, you know, design product cycles come and go, but if you've got a dozen companies, there's more of a chance that most of them will be having a decent run as opposed to just one or two or three. A wider swath of the country will benefit from the auto industry because you'll have investments not just in Michigan and Ohio and maybe Indiana, but also Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Virginia, West Virginia, Texas, and Georgia, and I'm sure I missed a state, California. The companies that make car parts and provide other services, such as dealerships, will have consolidated into enterprises that are stronger, although fewer in number. And they have more diverse customer bases. They're not going to all be dependent on GM or Ford or Chrysler, which is obviously a recipe for disaster when the economy goes down. Let me talk about Detroit and the suburbs. I live in Detroit. I live in the suburbs of Detroit. I live in Plymouth, Michigan. So this is not all abstract to me. It's certainly not abstract to my neighbors who are directly employed by the car business. Again, I'm going to try to paint you a positive scenario. What could happen? Detroit and the suburbs around it could benefit from kind of a Silicon Valley effect. We are the Silicon Valley of transportation engineering. We're going to have internal combustion engines motoring us around for a really long time. I hate to disappoint the folks who believe in hydrogen. If you want people who know how to engineer highly efficient, clean internal combustion engines that run on some form of petroleum, I know where they are. They're in Detroit. And somebody needs to hire them, and somebody needs to put them to work on these challenges. I do think that the challenges presented by the demand to make cars cleaner and greener could conceivably inspire a whole generation of smart people, maybe even some people who go to school here, to sign up with these companies if they see them not as old, slow-moving automakers, but as high-tech companies that happen to produce a product that's bigger than a BlackBerry. I mean, face it, which is more fun? I mean, I'm not an engineer, but which would be more fun? Designing another MP3 player or designing a car that can go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds and gets 100 miles to the gallon? That's the kind of dream we're talking about. You know, even if you got to 50, it would be an extraordinary achievement. In my vision, GM, Ford, and Fiat, oh, I'm sorry, Chrysler, will be competitive. They will earn money. They will be viable. They will not lag their Asian and European rivals. They will be an engine for innovation and growth in the economy, just as they were 50 or 60 years ago. They will have capital to invest in their products and their people instead of having to plow that money into pensions and their own private brand of Medicare. You know, I could make you a case that what's happened to GM is a little harbinger of what's about to happen to the national Medicare system, as we were just reported in our paper this morning, a lot of other papers as well. Okay, so can you hear the birds singing? See the rainbow? All right, what can go wrong? You know, this is the to be sure part. We call this in journalism, we call this the to be sure paragraph. To be sure. If the macro economy does not rebound in 2010 or, heaven help us, 2011, the U.S. auto industry is absolutely in trouble. I mean, a lot of this is not going to work if we don't get some kind of an economic rebound. The foreign manufacturers and the Detroit manufacturers and the government's investments in GM and Chrysler will be at great risk. GM's latest restructuring plan says the company wants to be profitable or at least break even at a sales rate of 10 million vehicles a year. I don't want to get into a lot of numbers, but there's some numbers that are worth remembering. Up until this past year, for roughly the last decade, we were selling 16 to 17 million vehicles a year. In hindsight, you could make a case, I would, that what we had was an automotive bubble that matched our housing bubble, and in fact was financed to a great degree by our housing bubble. People used their houses, refinanced their houses to take money out to go buy a new car or SUV. Well, that party sadly is over. And now we are in a situation where the market is probably going to readjust, at least for the midterm, to a lower level of travel. But I believe, and I think the car company people believe, that 10 million just won't float the boat. It's got to be 12, 13, 14 million for them to get above water with any kind of sustainable business. That's just one reason why the automakers really want Congress to pass what's this so-called Cash for Clunkers program to spur some demand. Thing number two that could go wrong. GM and Chrysler update Dickens and get stuck in bankruptcy court basically forever. Now, I mean, so, you know, Dickens goes to Motown. That's what could happen. Now, so far, it looks good for Chrysler not to get stuck in that. I will note, but try not to digress, that this has come at some cost to bondholders who felt like they had a contractual right for things to go otherwise. I stipulate to that, but at least so far, Chrysler seems to be on its way out of bankruptcy. We'll see what happens with GM. But if the companies don't emerge quickly from bankruptcies, customers do not have to wait to buy a car from these two companies. Plenty of options. Just go to your local dealership. Three, And this is one of the things that I think is very much in the balance. The government will effectively control GM and Chrysler along with the UAW, and the question will be whether the ownership, the new ownership, tries to force these companies to do something other than make money. Now, President Obama has made it very plain that he wants GM and Chrysler to build plug-in hybrids and other kinds of green vehicles. That's good. The fact is that at $2 a gallon, or even today, even at $2.30 or $2.40, whatever it is today, it's going up a little bit. But even at those levels, the only vehicles that Chrysler and GM know how to make money on right now are the big ones, because that's the kind of vehicle that their customer is willing to pay a premium to buy. These are also the only vehicles that they have to sell right now. I mean, someday there may be a Chrysler Fiat Cinquecento, the little mini car. It's very cute. It's so cute. You just want to... Sophia Loren, where is she? But it's not on sale now. What they have to sell now are Dodge Ram trucks, a couple hundred thousand of them. Please buy one. GM's Chevy Volt won't be on sale until 2010, and even then, it will probably be too expensive to be a profitable mass market hit of the sort that will generate cash to pay back the loans that you all have helped make to the company. Who says this? Is just some journalist saying this negative things? No, the president's own task force said this in a report March 30th that they delivered on the state of General Motors, which is very interesting to me. I mean, you've got Congress and the Obama administration have want the U.S. automakers, they've told the U.S. automakers they have to produce by 2020 fleets of cars that can basically get European levels of fuel economy, around 35 miles to the gallon. Many of you traveled to Europe, you've seen the fleet, that's what you're going to see. But the European governments support that by levying high fuel taxes, $6, $7 a gallon, which causes people in Europe to be willing to pay premium prices, $18,000, $19,000, $20,000, for a car that in this country fetches $13,000, $14,000, right? So that increment is the profit opportunity for the technology that makes all that work. In the high-tech industry, small is beautiful. In the car business in this country, we're not there yet. The nightmare scenario is that these companies, all of them, invest billions to build the modern fuel-efficient cars that Washington wants, and their most loyal customers, who are not the folks in DuPont Circle who commute to work on bikes on Birkenstocks, but Heartland folks who like trucks, and they like them big, and they're prepared to pay for them. And they will absolutely turn up their noses at something like a Cinquecento, pardon the Italian, and they'll buy used Chevy Suburbans instead. That's the nightmare scenario. And there is some indication that a little of this is happening now, because used SUV values are actually up over the last year pretty strongly, whereas the market price of a Toyota Prius has crashed. They're struggling to give them away. They have incentives on them now, whereas obviously a year ago you had to pay a premium just to look at one. Now they can't give them away. Well, they can give them away, but the price has crashed on them. Hybrid demand appears to be totally a function of gas price. President Obama, he's now shareholder in chief for these two companies. And what he does is going to have an enormous influence even on the rest of the auto industry that isn't directly owned by the government. I want to say this respectfully and carefully, but I believe that the more that he and the people he's hired, the extraordinarily smart, capable people he's hired to be on this auto task force, learn about how complex this business is, how many moving parts there are, what a Rubik's Cube it is as you try to get technology, consumer demand, government regulation, all aligned along the same axis. The more he learns about this, the more sincerely he will hold the view that he expressed he absolutely doesn't want to run car companies. It's not what he came to office to do. We are in uncharted waters economically in terms of this, the sort of the economic history of our country. I don't believe, certainly not since World War II, we've ever had this huge and direct an intervention in a industrial corporation. I'm not going to talk about the banks. We're talking about an industrial corporation that builds products that people buy and sell every day in the real world. We've had nothing like this. So it's an extraordinary experiment. There is a road to success. I tried to outline it, and your questions will tell me how convincing I was. But it's going to require some very deft steering to stay between the white lines. And with that, I thank you, and I look forward to questions.
Joe, if I can kick off the discussion, let me ask you two related questions. The first is, should Wagoner have been fired? And is the team that President Obama has put together to oversee the reconstruction of the automobile industry up to it? And what will they do differently than the previous management did?
Okay. I think the question about Rick Wagoner, I think the answer is that if you look at other companies that have had similar crises, basically failure, usually what happens is the new ownership or the new board of directors that comes in with the rescue money dismisses the top management, if only because they want to signal a clean break with the past. I do think in this case, it's been reported, and I think it's true, I know it's true, that there was some fundamental disagreements about how fast and how fast to do certain kinds of restructuring and how deep that restructuring should go. And again, we had a situation where you have essentially, I think it's clearer if you imagine that the government isn't the government, but rather, you know, Carl Icahn or somebody like that, a corporate raider. And you know, you look at it and say, well, we're going to provide the financing here, but you, senior management that got us into the mess that we're in, you have to go. We need fresh thinking. We don't want to have meetings about why what we did before was okay. We're just going to dispense with that. So I think in a way, it's not that he did something terrible or bad or he was culpable for some sort of wrongdoing. I just think that it was a situation where they wanted a fresh start. I think they knew that they had in Fritz Henderson a guy who was ready to sign on to a more aggressive, and when I say more aggressive, I mean broader in scope and also more aggressive in timetable. Just quickly, let me say, timetable is really a key to this, because I think Rick Wagoner, if he were here, would say, look, all the things that they're going to do are things that I outlined we should do and I said we should do. The counter would be, but you were going to wait until 2010 or 2011 to put these changes into effect. You were going to try to do it as sort of a gradual way to avoid, disruptive harm. And you ran out of time. And I think that's a fair way to look at it. You asked about the task force. I think the president has assembled a group of very capable, very smart people. But as I suggested in my talk, I think they're going to need more smart and capable people, including a lot of smart and capable people who know the ins and outs of the auto business. It's very, very complicated. And I just think they're going to, as they said in Jaws, you're going to need a bigger boat.
Hi, I have a question, a piece of information, and a correction. There are three Toyota brands in this country, actually, because the Scion is the third,
yes.
Right. The piece of information, you talked about a 100 mile per gallon car that gets to 60 miles an hour in 6 seconds. Giorgio Giugiaro, the Italian designer, has built a sports car, which has, it's electric with a very small internal combustion engine, which is designed essentially to recharge the batteries, and that'll get 100 miles to the gallon and gets to 60, and I think it's under 4 seconds.
Right. And there's the Tesla, and also I think the Chevy Volt.
Yeah,
probably do
yeah.
What I
so
said
the
too.
Technology is there. And the question comes from a book that I read. It's some 35 years old by Brock Yates, who is editor of one of the major car magazines. I think it was called The Decline and Fall of the American Auto Industry. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, it was a study of the American car industry, and it focused on General Motors and their attempt to compete with the Honda Accord. And the designers and the engineers came up with a car that could have done the job, but the executives had them cut back on quality. And they ended up with the Cavalier, the Chevy Cavalier. And in their wisdom, they eventually turned it into the Cadillac Cimarron. Now, that was 35 years ago. In the whole rebuilding of Detroit and attempting to compete with the hybrids, they came up with mild hybrids that were expensive and didn't do the job. Where were the boards of trustees in this time?
Well, I think the answer is, in the last 10 years, you could fairly find fault with the boards of directors at GM, or the board of directors at GM, for not pushing hard enough to do what they knew they needed to do. I might argue with some of the direction that you're pointing at, but I think you're basically right that these companies spent way too much time, certainly GM, spent way too much time and money over the last decade in sort of gradual efforts to fix their fundamental cost problems that related largely to their union contracts and their legacy health benefit agreements, and also the sort of the effort to support their brand network. And it was enormous sums of money went into trying to shore up the pension funds and the healthcare funds and subsidizing the sort of the high costs of their old act. And if they had redirected that money toward trying to figure out how you can take technology such as you described and sweating the costs out of it so you could make it a mass market kind of technology, which they haven't achieved yet, but that's the goal, right? That's the dream. If they had applied that money to doing even less exciting but equally substantial things to make, a pickup truck that could, instead of getting 18 miles to the gallon, maybe gets 24. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's on a percentage basis, it's quite a lot. I mean, all these things that they could have done with the money that they spent instead on sort of nursing along the old business model, because they didn't want to take the pill. They didn't want to disrupt the ongoing operations by provoking a confrontation with the union or scaring the shareholders or doing any other things. Now, in hindsight, I mean, it's easy to say, look, they should have done all these things. You're right. I being 2 weeks from potential bankruptcy is a clear punishment for that failure. I think it speaks for itself. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's sort of what my view of it is.
Thank you for an excellent presentation. The capitalist model is based on competition. And if we, the public, are invested in a company like General Motors, it seems to me that there's going to be incredible forces there to subvert that competition so that companies that did play by the rules and were successful to this point, like Ford and Toyota, are going to be unfairly penalized, especially in a diminished market. So I wonder if you'd address the fairness of this question. Are we going to end up with something not capitalist?
I think you have raised, I think, one of the many, many difficult questions that's been put on the table by what they've done. You're absolutely right. GM... Let me give you a hypothetical. I mean, this is the kind of risk that they're in. Let's say that for whatever reason, GM decides that it's in their interest perhaps to keep people working, to overbuild, and then run a fire sale. Zero for 60, employee pricing for everyone. They might make that decision because their prime objective is not making, 5% return on revenue or whatever number they pick, but rather to avoid layoffs, because the union is, a 39% holder. Let's just imagine that. Now, they do that. They overbuild. They run the fire sale. And there's Ford with their money that they've raised at cost. I mean, they're paying a pretty good coupon, I believe, for the bonds that they've issued. And they just issued stock the other day, which I think is quite an achievement. But nonetheless, this is money that they owe. The shareholders want a return on that someday. They're going to want a dividend one of these days. So Ford has a cost of money that's probably higher than GM's right now. They've had to pay to retire the share of their union healthcare debt that they agreed to retire with their own money. General Motors is getting a government loan to do that. At least that's the proposal. So I agree that there is a... I'm not quite sure what the economic term for it would be, but there is definitely a risk in having an industry that is sort of split three ways now. between foreign companies that have kind of one business profile and one set of cost of capital and one employee cost profile lower. Ford, which is, you know, the old Detroit model, but it's fixing itself with its own money or money that it's raised on its own and has to be accountable for that. And then GM and Chrysler, which are financed by the government, and if they aren't really rigorous and careful, could do things that would be to the detriment of the other two. And I can't tell you how that's going to happen, because that's what we're going to find out in the next 2 years. Can they resist the temptation to do things that only a government-run company can do, that are to the detriment of the other enterprises who are trying to, you know, fight on the same playing field? You know, there's absolutely a question there.
Could you talk a little bit about the foreign versus domestic content with regard to parts and materials, labor, technology, and design? What are the trends there that you see? And also, what is the status of government policy and regulation in that area? I guess what I'm getting at is, could we get to a point where Honda, Toyota, and the others would be satisfied with the profits, but the U.S. public would get the benefits of the economy taking place in our territory?
I think the trend on that is probably going in a... Well, the trend on that is for all the car companies, all the car makers, to source their parts and the services that they buy on a global basis. That does not mean that the U.S. loses, because in a lot of cases, the U.S. might actually win in a case like that. I mean, the piece cost of shipping or of buying, a car seat made in China, it might be $100 less, but that's in China. Once you get through shipping the thing here and putting up with the logistical hassles of having a 4-month supply of seats on ships and all that stuff, you might find out that, in fact, it's actually cheaper to build the seat right here in America, you know, a mile from the assembly line, which in the case of seats, I think is pretty much what they have decided. So I think what you're getting at is something which has been going on for a number of years in the industry, which is the idea that there is such a thing as a purely American car is kind of going out the window. There are Hondas that have higher content of American-made parts or American-provided services than Chevrolets. My own fleet maybe is a quick example. I own a Subaru WRX, a Chevrolet HHR, a Toyota Camry, old Toyota Camry, and a Saturn Astra. My wife owns the Astra, but that's my family fleet. I said I was from Detroit, right? It's 4 people, 4 cars. No, I'm not proud of that. Guess which one was assembled in the United States? The person who said Toyota got it right. It's the Toyota. And that's, there you go. That says it all. I mean, my Chevrolet was made in Mexico. My Saturn was, or my wife's Saturn was assembled in Belgium by General Motors and shipped here. I mean, so the business is hugely global, but the good news is that the United States actually turns out to be a pretty darn good place to do this kind of work, especially if you're selling to this market, because A, it's a huge market, and even at 12 million, it'll be a huge market. And B, if you get your costs right, the kind of high-tech manufacturing that car making requires is actually best done, at least for the moment, or can be well done in a country like this. My next talk, when I come back, I'll talk to you about how scary it is that the Chinese are learning how to do that kind of high-tech manufacturing very, very, very quickly.
Question about financial credit. Unless our government is willing to support financially the auto manufacturers ad infinitum, those manufacturers are going to have to go back to the credit markets. And as we know, lenders are willing to give you a more favorable term of rate of interest, if somehow their security interests are protected over those who loan money with less security interests. So the papers are filled with a lot of stories in recent weeks over secured creditors being, their interests are being ignored or subordinated to those who have less secured interests. So how can the manufacturers really have access to the credit they need if the secured creditors' interests are not being protected as has been the case over years?
I think you've identified a huge risk here. I know, you know, my paper has certainly been writing about exactly those issues. And I have been reading all of that, and I'm aware of all of that. And I think this is one of those things where we aren't going to know the answer to your question until we get a little bit further down the road and they attempt to go to the private credit markets and see what kind of reception they get. And I do think that there's going to have to be, a certain amount of hand-holding now with private investors if they really, because they're going to need to do what amounts to an IPO of GM and of GM for sure. I don't know about Chrysler. I think Chrysler maybe gets absorbed by Fiat in the end game. But with GM, it appears that they're going to have to do some kind of an IPO unless they want this to be a nationalized government-owned enterprise for a long period of time. And you're right. It's clear if you read the comments in my paper that the investors and the funds that provide this kind of capital are not happy with what they have seen happen in the Chrysler case, where they were, you know, put down in the list of creditors, and I understand that the president and his task force have argued that this what was done for the greater public interest, and I think it remains to be seen whether Wall Street and the people who have a fiduciary duty to make sure that if they lend money they get it back, are going to accept that. That's a big piece of unfinished business.
Do you see Congress ever supporting increased gasoline taxes so that our taxes are more nearly in line with those in Europe?
That's what they say today, and they've actually said it for a long time. I think the problem, this is a big problem in Washington. Okay, this is bigger than a gas tax question. There's a big problem in Washington, and that is that the government has outlined, Congress and the administration have outlined a program of spending in a wide array of areas that is way bigger than the amount of revenue that they can get, that they know how to get their hands on under the current tax regime. And to bring it back down to your gas tax question, right now in Congress, they're starting the debate on the highway bill, which I think is a five-year mission. It's a different thing. But the highway bill, which is a five-year bill, it's huge. And they don't have the money to finance it. Gas tax revenues are falling for whatever reason. I know there's people who argue about that. But gas tax revenues are falling. And they're not adequate to the task. So they're talking about things like putting GPS locators on cars to sort of tax you by the mile. We'll see, I don't know about that. But the pressure to raise revenue to finance various functions of the government, the ones you like and the ones you don't like, is enormous. It's building. And I don't know if they will resist the temptation to tax either fuel or vehicle travel in some way, because otherwise there's not enough money to do the things that everybody knows need to be done. You were just on Route 66 at rush hour. The roads are not adequate to the traffic that we have on them, there's going to be pressure to do something about that. So, but just one last thing on that: it is, I think, extraordinary that President Obama has basically ruled out any kind of a gas tax for the purpose of discouraging or encouraging efficient car purchases or discouraging gas guzzlers. He's going to try to do it a different way. I mean, we'll see if that way works, which is, encouraging technology through regulation.
Joe, by virtue of the fact that you're in contact with the engineering, Warren, Tech Center, and so forth up in Detroit, Can you give us an indication of how you see the technical developments of the engine coming about over the next 10, 20 years? And principally, I was wondering about natural gas as being one of the first things to come in to supplant oil by virtue of the fact of its, that it's readily available, right, at least for the next couple of generations.
Right. Quickly, over the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to see what I view as kind of a burst of innovation on the basic internal combustion gasoline-fueled engine. You're going to hear a lot from a bunch of different companies about direct injection engines. They're sort of moving toward a hybrid of a gasoline engine and a diesel engine. It's kind of converging in the middle. So they're going to start applying technologies that increase the fuel economy of internal combustion engines by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8%, allow them to do with a four-cylinder engine the work that they used to do with a 6, do with a 6 what they used to do with an 8. And that's going to happen in a big way over the next 2 to 5 years, the next product cycle. And that's all enabled by better both software and hardware that they've finally sort of brought to maturity over the last decade. Okay, natural gas. Natural gas has the same chicken-egg problem that a lot of alternative to petroleum have, which is that the startup costs for switching the fleet to natural gas are extraordinarily high. We don't have very many natural gas fueling stations anywhere. They're not public. They're not public anywhere much. There's a few hundred, I think, in the United States. Maybe a couple thousand. To change that would require billions of dollars of investment that nobody wants to make. But what I do think that you'll start to see, and I think you're already seeing, is I do think that you'll start to see corporate fleets and other kinds of institutions that have fleets of cars that do a duty cycle. They run around and come back to base every night, where you can have a $500,000 natural gas refueling station, and that's a corporate capital investment, and it pays off. I think you'll start to see more and more of that, A, because of marketing by people like Boone Pickens, and B, because you're right, there's a lot of natural gas, and it is a reasonably effective fuel. But as a consumer item, I think natural gas is still a ways off for the reasons of infrastructure and also reasons that having to do with the range of those kinds of vehicles. It's not as much. I'll just add this thought. You've touched on something that I think is really critical to how the industry develops over the next decade or so. And that is, are we, as the United States, as a market, as a people, are we going to start to look at cars in a different way? Which is, are we going to, since the Model T, our view is we want to have a car that can do almost anything that we want it to do. Go 500 miles in one direction, carry a load of stuff, carry 5 people to grandma's house, over the river and through the woods. In the last 15 years with SUVs, it was literally over the river and through the woods. And it's sort of the Viking stove approach to cars. It's this thing that can smelt gold on in your kitchen. That's what we're going to have. Well, we've blown that up. So now are we going to start to think, well, wait a minute. What I want is an electric car that will do my commuting for me, 10 miles out, 10 miles back. If I want to go to grandma's house over the river and through the woods, maybe I have an SUV, but I only use it for that purpose. In other words, a car that is, you own cars to suit certain purposes, or you own one car and you rent an SUV when you want to go over the river and through the woods. Very different model of how we buy and sell transportation, but maybe that's where we want to go.
You're getting around to the subject which I wanted to ask you about, and that was the Model T. It seems like the Ford company was the basis of or the bedrock of our automobile industry. Most of your emphasis has been on General Motors and Chrysler. Could you cover just briefly what the role of Ford is going to be in the future, hopefully?
Okay. Yeah, sure. No, yes, you're right. I focus on GM and Chrysler because they're the ones that are about to be owned by the government. Ford, if Ford gets lucky and plays the its cards right, they may wind up once again as the largest single automaker in the United States. I want to emphasize the words lucky and play cards right. They've really got to do just about everything right. They're working like demons to do this. But I do think that they have an opportunity that is both structural in the sense of the way they have decided to structure their business. And it may also be an opportunity that's created by public perception and public attitudes. I get a lot of emails from people when I write about this subject for the journal, from people who basically say, I don't want to have anything to do with a company that's run by the government. Now, I'm not here to comment on that. I'm just telling you that I get that. And if Ford is able to adroitly capitalize on the idea that they're the American car company that's doing it on its own, and if they are able to effectively market the generation of vehicles that they're just starting to bring out now, which are, I think, on the whole, better designed and equipped with better technology and more compelling technology than anything they've offered in quite a long time, then they might, they could do very well. But they're going to need certain things to break their way, starting, as is suggested, with the macroeconomy. I can't understate the importance of that. They can't make it if the macroeconomy does not recover. Well, let me retract that. To make it without a recovery in the macroeconomy was going to be extraordinarily hard.
In the 3.5 minutes that we have remaining, I'd like to ask you to comment on the relationships between the manufacturers and their dealer networks. We read every day that the General Motors and some of the others are looking at ways to reduce their dealer networks, to skinny them out. And I wonder if you could kind of give us a primer on the economics of the relationship between the manufacturers and the dealers, and perhaps give us some ideas to how they may do the thinning.
The National Auto Dealers Association, which is represents a very powerful group of people, who basically car dealers in every county and community, almost every community in this country, are actually, I think today, having a fly-in in Washington to register their dismay at the way that the Obama Task Force and Chrysler and GM are trying to thin out the dealer ranks. Put this simply, basically, people talk about GM dealers as if GM owns the dealers. They don't. Dealers are independent business people. They have their own capital in the game. It actually makes a lot of sense. But they also have rights, property rights, essentially, that are guaranteed by state franchise laws that dealers have managed to get passed over the years. And one of the many, many risk factors here is that the dealers will be able to assert those rights strongly enough and effectively enough to slow down this train. Because GM can't just fire their dealers. They have to go at it a certain way. And basically, they closed Oldsmobile several years ago. It wound up costing them $2 billion to buy out the franchise rights, or essentially a property right, of the dealers affected. Obviously, they don't want to do that now. This final thing I'll say about that is that the dealers are making an argument and that GM and Chrysler and the government are cutting off their nose to spite their face. If you get rid of these distribution outlets, all you're doing is getting rid of potential sales. You're not really saving any money. The companies will argue, look, sustaining these franchise outlets, building cars to sit on their lots, sustaining brands that have basically run out their useful lives is a cost we can no longer bear. There's going to be a big fight about this. People who've invested 1, 2, 3 generations of their family's lives in an enterprise like a car dealership, and believe me, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about people, whose grandfather owned this dealership or their father owned the dealership. Pardon me. You don't give that up easily, they're going to fight. And they're doing it today, and I think that fight is going to extend over a number of weeks, and we'll see how it gets resolved. They are the next round of essentially of creditors, if you will. When Chrysler did its deal with their holdout creditors, all they did was break through to this next level, which is their dealers who are now going to come and say, look, you know, we have a right here. You can't just cut us off. So we'll see how that works out. They will lose market share if they close down their distribution, I think. But I think that was, they'll argue that's market share they'd lost already. They just didn't know it yet.
The road from Washington to Charlottesville was not over the river and through the woods, but probably would have been a lot easier if it had been. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.